And your name, sir?
Blind Eagles.
And your date of birth?
April 23rd, 1902.
And where were you born?
New Westminster.
Great. And what have you done in your life?
What have I done?
How have you been related to the university?
Well, I've been a student, and I've been a professor, and I've been a professor from 1929 till 1949, except for 1 year when I had to leave the university because they didn't have enough money. I was among a group that had to leave at the time in 1930-31, at that depression. I know all about that. And I was dean of agriculture from 49 to 67, and from 67 until now, I've been a lecturer in biochemistry in the Faculty of Medicine. So I've been at the university quite a long while.
What year did you enter the Fairview Shacks?
What year? 1918, as a freshman.
And graduated in what year?
In 22.
In 22. What do you remember about the conditions of the Fairview Shacks in 1918?
Well, the so-called shacks are made up of three different kinds of buildings. They're the main building. It was the arts building and the administration building, which was to have been a TB hospital, and that was the main building. Then they had the other facilities from Old McGill, and the government once it was determined that they could not proceed to start the university when it began in 15 at Point Grey, the government gave money to build additional things, and it built the lecture accommodation and an auditorium and a cafeteria to start the university. That was done. So there were rooms X, Y, and Z with the great lecture halls and the auditorium, which served various things for the beginnings of the Players Club and the Musical Society and so on. And when the veterans started to return, and they only the in my freshman year, the only ones returning were wounded, men who were wounded, and some of them were very severely wounded. In the chemistry class, I sat next to Bill Gray, who's now gone, who graduated with me, and he had most of his one face shot off. He was there in his kilts, sat next to him in the chemistry lectures and so on. So most of them, were in uniform and were very severely wounded in various ways, and they're returning. And most of them had previously had university experience. And as my wife had just said, when they were returning, when they left to go overseas, they probably left in January, and they're given their year as if they hadn't completed it. And then they came back and they had to pick things up, and they had very great difficulty, but they did it courageously.
Yeah. Were there any sport facilities at the Fairview Shacks?
No. The only sports facilities were at King Edward High School, which was right next door, and these facilities were used there. There was an understanding that they could use, but they were not very great. Now then, and there was the COTC, to which, as a freshman, the war was still on, and I belonged to it paraded on the university grounds, right there. But the shacks, the so-called shacks, they're not. Then each succeeding year, while the university was still there, particularly in 1920, new additions were made. There was a second floor was put on the biological sciences building, and tents were built to accommodate chemistry laboratories. And students went to, they took over a church, a Baptist church, for lecture halls. The agricultural students were located in Braemar, which is on Broadway. This was their headquarters for themselves. And of course, the agriculture students also had to go out to Point Grey to where the agricultural facilities were. They had been established prior to the university, while the university was opening, you see. And they went out by in what did you call them about it? The buses that well, anyhow, Model T Ford. They were and there were no 10th Avenue, remember. They went out around Marine Drive.
Well, did the students feel that their needs were being accommodated within these shacks?
That the students were being, we were being accommodated. Yes, well accommodated. And remember that the staff had been handpicked, and it was a very interesting staff. It was picked by Dr. Westbrook as the president, and he brought in some very distinguished people, and they were all conscious of the fact, I would say, that they were doing something that was new. They were starting a university, which not too many people have the opportunity of doing. And there was an enthusiasm. And Dr. Westbrook had given its motto to MS, it's up to you and it's yours. And the faculty and students together saw, and that has continued to today, all those that were in Fairview, and what they're still doing for the university, those of us that are still alive from the Fairview crowd, who are conscious of the fact that the, and that's what this symbolizes, the Karen.
So that Dr. Westbrook and the students then were enthusiastic about this Pioneer University?
Oh, of course. All the faculty. Isn't this right, Butter?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yes. There was an enthusiasm. Oh, yeah. Enthusiasm is the word. And you know what enthusiasm means.
Sure do.
Entheos, the God within.
Good.
That's what it means.
I didn't know that, no.
Oh, well, entheos, the God within. Well, there was a God within. That's right.
Is that Dr. Westbrook?
Well, with all the faculty and so on, yeah.
Well, what else do you remember about Dr. Westbrook and his interaction with the students?
Well, the only time I ever saw him was when I saw him in 1915 in New Westminster, when he and Dr. Klink spoke to quite a large gathering of people of the Lower Fraser Valley, telling them what this university was going to be. And at the time, and when I heard him, I was not conscious of the fact that he didn't know really whether or not it would open or not.
So you didn't see Dr. Westbrook at the Fairview campus?
No, he was ill. He had taken ill, and Dr. Klink was acting president. But I do remember, the most significant thing I remember of my first year was the opening ceremonies of the university, at which Dr. Westbrook was very, very ill. But we were the fourth class to start, you see, 15, 16, 17, 18. We were the fourth, and the class of 19 would be the first class to graduate fully from UVC. So they were seniors when I was a freshman. You see, well, and but Dr. Westbrook as president always had a message at the opening ceremonies where all the students were assembled in the auditorium. He was ill, but I'll never forget. The most impressive thing that impressed me at the time was the two things. What Dr. Klink, who was the acting president, read the message that Dr. Westbrook had prepared, and he was on his deathbed then. And I remember the students were very motivated by the not only what was in what he said, but the way Dr. Klink read it. And Dr. Klink and Dr. Westbrook were very intimate and close with one another.
So what do you recall of Dr. Klink then, and of his interaction with the students while you were at the Fairview campus?
Well, he
what kind of man was he?
Well, he was a very able and, well, he understood what he was one of the few people who really understood and was brought there by Dr. Westbrook, who understood and could have and who was able to translate into action what Dr. Westbrook's dreams. What I'm saying there, and he knew Dr. Westbrook to that extent, hadn't gotten to know him, you see, an associate with him, and he had been selected to be acting president, and then he became president reluctantly. He wanted to continue to be Dean of Agriculture, but the Board of Governors wanted him specifically to be president. And so, but he was entirely a different kind of person than Dr. Westbrook, but he put together the university, really, is what he did, and moved it to Point Grey.
Well, how do you think the government felt towards the university at that time?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I'm not a politician, but I would say that the government and the people of the province, any form of education in British Columbia has always been a debatable matter in the public mind. For instance, and it showed again in 1930 and 31 when there was a move, you see, to close the university. At that time, whether you're aware of that or not, well, you haven't read all of Tuamet to find that out. You see, well, there was, you see. No. So you ask, what's the... No, that's a government a lot later. So you've all... I don't think that will arise again now, but there are those, I think, within the government who think maybe there's always those who think they're spending too much money on education.
Do you think the government felt that at the time? That too much money was going towards...
I think the government throughout, on the whole, I would say, had been very sympathetic to the university within the bounds of what they can do, the demands that are upon them, which are pretty fantastic, as you know.
Do you recall how the community supported the university? Were they aware of the needs of the varsity at the time?
I would say that the
students, you don't know those things, you know.
As a student, well, no, you don't know that. I think in retrospect, I would say yes, that there were various groups in society where, for instance, the medical profession, the engineering profession, the farm people of the province, at the time, there had been a Royal Commission on Agriculture, and they were very delighted that their sons and daughters were going to be able to take agriculture at the university. You see, and they look forward to the advancement and the whole question of everything, every phase of university. They had supporters, and they always have had. Mm-hmm. Now, the extent to which a government to answer why how you think they're sympathetic, that's a difficult thing to say. They are very difficult. Am I saying it about right, about it?
As a student.
No, as a student, you. You weren't conscious of it.
No, you weren't. And when she's asking about Dr. Clink, you see, it's very difficult for us to go back because in later years, we were very great personal friends. When Dr. Clink died, my husband went right over and helped to get the pallbearers, you see. So we can't go back to think what we thought as a student, you see.
Because you're so close to him as a friend.
Yes, yeah. So it's very difficult.
Well, it's a very interesting thing, you see. And for instance, you ask about I'll tell you an interesting aside. Don't get this in it anyway. But the premier of the province at the time was the Honorable John Oliver, who had no university education at all. You see, my grandmother was the midwife to all his children born on the Delta in the 90s, in the turn of the century. So, and I knew him personally.
Oh, you did?
Oh, sure.
Oh, terrific.
See? And you see, then another connection, that whether Mrs. Lett gave it to you or not, I don't know, is Mrs. Farris. Mrs. J.W.B. Farris, the first president of the University Women's Club, who started it. Well, her husband was the Attorney General.
We're all that together.
He was the Attorney General. Now, are you going to ask what? And John Oliver, although he'd had no university education, his own son graduated medicine from McGill, and he had another one that had gone in agriculture in Ontario at OAC, and so on. So these, I would say that the governments have been sympathetic.
Okay, I got a sense that the students would not tolerate the conditions at the Fairview Shacks anymore, and that.
No, that is not true.
Okay.
I would say that is not true. I would say the students were very conscious of the fact that they were living in wretched conditions, and that's true. And they knew that they were not ideal, and so on, and they were anxious to improve their own themselves. Yes.
They were anxious to improve the conditions.
Of course.
Did they ever have any suggestions as to how to improve their own conditions?
Yes. Well, the Arts 20 relay is an example of it. The class of Arts 20. As you know, the classes started to give, in very small-like terms compared to today, money towards the university, part of the it's-up-to-you business. And when they came to debate this in the class of 20, the proposal was put forward, and they weren't unanimous like everything else. Hugh Kingside put it forward and said, let's do something that will tend to bring the attention of the public to the plight of the university and move us to Point Grey, and to give us the conditions that we should have. Now, some of them were opposed to that. They didn't think this was desirable for all kinds of reasons. Hugh Kingside will probably tell you exactly why and why and so on. I don't know. But anyhow, I think by a pretty good majority, and everybody agreed to it, they decided to give this as their valedictory gift to the university, was to give a cup. From the class, just that would be and to run a race from Fairview to Point Grey, and that this would serve to bring to the attention through the press and all kinds of things that the public to be aware that the students were intensely interested. That's really the genesis of it. Now it's out of that. That is really the genesis of the student activity that eventually led to the Great Trek that really did lead the government to advancing the money.
So that what do you feel the purpose of the race was?
The purpose of the was a student effort to bring to public attention in a proper manner the plight of the university. That's about right about it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't recall any of the students, any talk about complaining about conditions.
No.
Maybe some of the arts people have nothing better to do. It's always the arts people that do all the complaining.
But I don't think this is true. But you've heard this, have you?
I sense that in the research, that the students, in the research, reading the old UBC articles, that the conditions were absolutely intolerable, and that the government was unsympathetic, and that the students had to do something themselves, and this would stimulate morale. This would draw the public to the needs of the university.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But it was a feeling, a human feeling on the part of students that it was up to them. What could they do? As students.
Now, how closely was that motto followed? I mean, it's so appropriate in this situation where the students had to do something themselves.
Well, they
and
did.
The motto certainly lends itself to that, to encouraging the students to doing something.
Well, the students at the University of British Columbia have done more for their university through the years, and to my knowledge, than any other university in Canada. They built. Look what they've done. They built the gymnasium. They built the first gymnasium that is now gone, that became the women's gym. And they built the main gymnasium. They built the aquarium. They've done all kinds of things.
Who encouraged the students to live up to their motto? Do you feel the faculty were
well, the faculty did. The presidents did, and the faculty. But this is part of the tradition of the university.
You see, if you walked into a lab Monday morning, and you hadn't gone to the football game on Saturday, the first thing the man greeted you with. Where were you on Saturday? I mean, and I went east. As a matter of fact, I went east with Harry Warren. I happened to be on the train. You know, maybe, no, it wasn't Harry Warren asked, but I was talking to a trauma lad, and he said, what are you interested in? And I said, we all go to everything. We go to the debates, we go to the,
yeah,
the football games, and we just go to everything. It's our university, we go to everything, you see.
This is a question of entheos, enthusiasm. And as my wife says, we went to the students went to the head debates, inter-class debates. We went to the debates, you went to the soccer game, you went to the rugby game, you went to the basketball game, and so on, and the professors went. Now you wouldn't find a professor anywhere today. And you wouldn't find many students either.
No, I'm afraid
it's... Well, anyway, this was true. Now, what you call that, I don't know. Of course, it was small. It was small. It was small. And there was a coherence. But there's no evidence of I wouldn't say that there was... I would say that in our time, there wasn't a figment of that I'm conscious of antagonism.
Where and how was the challenge of the race issued?
Well, I don't know that, other than they proposed that this is one way of doing it, and they gave a cup, and that's it. I don't know how it came to be staged. I don't know.
Okay.
But had the Art 20 crowd not had that within them, this would not have occurred.
Why do you think they chose a sporting event? Why do you think they chose a sporting event to achieve their goal?
Well, I don't know. Maybe what my wife was saying, that sporting events, all students took part in events like that. And I don't know.
It's more spectacular than a debate.
Yeah, it'd be more spectacular. A debate wouldn't do anything. No. No, they in their debating societies, they debated should the university be moved. That went on too, but of course that was a local. That was among the students, and the faculty.
Can you remember what kind of impact the race made on the community?
Oh yes, it was very favorable. It was well conducted, just the same as the Great Trek. When the Great Trek was conducted, you read the papers of that time. It was well conducted, and they saw to it that everything was done and properly, and so on. And it had a very favorable response. I would say a favorable response.
Did it get as much visibility as the Great Trek?
As the Great Trek? Oh, well, it wasn't... Well, the Great Trek, of course, was a fantastic undertaking. It was a definite, entire student body undertaking, in which they went throughout the whole province in collecting names throughout that whole summer of 1922. That's of another order. But what I'm saying is the origin and the genesis of the Great Trek was in the beginnings of it were in the Arch 20 relay.
Do you feel this laid the gave the impetus or started a momentum amongst the student body to achieve the goal of moving to Point Grey?
Yes, I think so. Now, the person that could tell you more about what happened in the Great Trek than anybody is if you can get a hold of Dr. Ab Richards, who was the leader of, who's in Sydney and Vancouver Island. And he's the one that could tell you. The whole history of that, and he and Marjorie Agnew, who's now dead, was the secretary, and though with all the correspondence, fantastic correspondence, he deposited it all in the archives in the university. So if you want to get... it'll be under lock and key, but whether or not it's worth in relation to the Arch 20 relay, I don't know. But all the details about how it came about the trek are recorded there.
Right. Do you feel that did you feel that the race boosted student morale in any way?
Well, I think they said well. I think that in the sense that if it needed boosting, I think the morale was pretty high. It was a culmination of an expression of a spirit. What spirit it was?
A spirit in the positive sense?
Yeah, of course. Well, that's what 2MS is. A motto is a spirit. The spirit within. The God within.
Right.
That's what it is.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
Isn't that right?
I like that. Did you participate in the first few years of the Arts 20?
Did I race in it?
Yeah.
No, not as a class. I didn't participate as a runner at all. I participated as a supporter of the concept and also helped with the class of 22. They had to look after people and get them from here to there and so on, and these are things that were done.
How much support or how much attention did the Arts 20 receive in the 3 years that it was on during your time at the university?
Well, it was looked forward to and with anticipation as an annual event. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Good.
Oh, yes.
Did all the students turn up for that event as well?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They were participating in it in a way that, as they have to today too, you know, in looking after the getting the runners at the various stations and so on. But then the rest of the body would be at the finish.
So, do you remember any of the rules of the race or any regulations of the relay?
No, I don't. I can't tell you exactly. I was talking to. Have you seen Dr. Warren yet?
Yes. I saw him yesterday.
I'm not quite. You see, they ran at one. I'm not. In my mind, I'm not. And I'm talking to Mr. Arkley. Which way they ran it? You see, at one time, I think the first time they ran it, they ran from Fairview to Point Grey.
Well, I believe, sir, it was from Point Grey to Fairview.
No, the very first time?
Yeah.
All the time?
For the first 6 years, and then it was changed in 1927.
Oh, well, I don't know the details of that.
No, that's okay.
Well, so they ran from Point Grey to the university?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. Well, that's what I remember that, except that I thought the first one may have gone the other way. But maybe that's not right.
I believe it's from Point
Grey. Yeah.
Okay, so that the race did become an annual spectator highlight?
Oh, it was a highlight.
Oh, good.
That's right, better, didn't it?
Good.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you can say about the times as far as student-initiated events are concerned to move the university to Point Grey?
Well, I think that there...
Anything about their spirit or involvement?
Yes, and of course remember that in 1919, the first real contingent of veterans returned. Now this is, maybe somebody hasn't told you this, what my wife was just saying, that and they had a tremendous effect on those of us that were younger, you see. They constitute... The men's side, not the women's side, constituted a large proportion of the male population of the university were returned veterans from 1919 on. So that the classes of, not 20, they had some, but particularly 21, 22, and then 23 was another thing again. But 21 and 22, they had a very high proportion of in our 2 years of returned veterans, you see, who were somewhat older than we were, and they came back to the university, and they had a very significant influence on the conduct of the university. For instance, Dr. Richards, the leader of the Great Trek, was a veteran of had been 4 years overseas. You see.
So they provided some mature leadership.
Oh yes, they did. No, but we were still, and we were part of it, and so on. And we were fortunate in this sense that they became our pals, and I guess we became their pals, and it still holds until today. And which only they're nearly all gone, not quite, but for instance, our years, 21 and 22, are having our 60th anniversary at our home here this August, this July.
Oh, okay.
And what's left of them? And there aren't too many of them. But isn't this right about it, particularly the men, you
not
see?
Not many men.
No, there aren't many men. There are all kinds of women. and the younger, but the return there not too many of them left. But what I was going to say was they gave a tremendous steadying influence, and they were into and they had been through quite a bit, remember, in the war, and they knew what adversity was. We all knew what adversity was, and anybody trying to tell you that you were opposed just because there was a realization that we could do something ourselves to advance this cause, but it was never anything picky or like that. It was a laudable endeavor that you were after.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Eagles.
You think that is this the kind of thing you want?
Super.